well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with Knox Williams from the American Suppressor Association here in just a minute or two. Got a lot to talk about, actually, with Knox, from Representative Andrew Clyde's letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi to the DOJ's position on NFA items, and even more. So we'll get to that here momentarily. Also, just a reminder, we've got to today's Armed Citizen story, Good Deed of the Day, our recidivist report coming up as well. And we'll also take a look at the cases that the Supreme Court scheduled to consider in conference today, whether or not they do and whether or not they take action, of course, remains to be seen, but we'll talk about that in just a little bit as well. Right now, though, let's get started with our conversation with Knox Williams. First topic of conversation, the nomination of Robert Sakata, the current deputy director of the ATF, to become the permanent director of that agency, a move that has been greeted with a lot of positivity from the firearms industry, including the American Suppressor Association. Take a look and a listen. Knox, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Cam, it's always a pleasure, man.
Well, listen, we always love talking with you, and we got a lot of stuff to talk about. But I want to get started with the news that broke yesterday. President Donald Trump nominating ATF Deputy Director Robert Sakata to become the permanent director of the ATF. We've seen a lot of positive reaction across the industry. The first reaction I actually saw was from the American Suppressor Association. And it seems like you all are very happy with President Trump's pick.
We are. Look, I mean, ATF has got its problems. There's no doubt about that. We're not here to debate that. But as long as that agency exists, it needs a politically appointed head if we are to do the things that we want to be able to do in reforming that organization and protecting lawful gun owners and the gun industry. And Rob Sakata's got a heck of a track record. Frankly, out of everybody who's internal at the ATF, he is not only the best choice there, he would be a good choice outside of that. So he's somebody who we have been able to work with, during this administration directly, and who has been an incredibly effective advocate for gun rights.
That's good. And, one of the things that I was talking about yesterday is that it's a little unusual from the respect that President Trump has nominated a lot of outsiders, right, to head up agencies, for better or for worse. But, one of the things about having somebody like Sakata step in is you've got that institutional knowledge, but it does seem like also a desire for reform, right? So you couple those two things together, you hopefully have somebody who knows where to reform, right? And has a better idea of what to prioritize so that the ATF, again, I think we've seen several important steps towards, reorienting the agency, right? I mean, under the Biden administration, I called it an armed wing of the gun control lobby. And I don't think that is the case today.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the left was very, very effective at weaponizing the government against citizens and folks who, like in other circumstances, people would call political dissidents, aka conservatives, their opposition. A person like Sakata knows how to call balls and strikes in a very fair and effective way, right? And that's really what that agency needs. It needs to make sure that it's not treating law-abiding citizens like criminals like we had under Dettelbach and under the Biden administration, but rather protecting the constitutional rights of those citizens. That's what the government exists for, right? Or at least that's what it should exist for, is protecting those rights, frankly, against itself. But Sakata's a guy who's again, he's got a heck of a track record, and he is somebody that, at least based on the past, almost year that we've been working with him, has been truly fantastic. Again, not going out of his way to be pro-gun just for the sake of being pro-gun, but doing the right thing, which happens to be pro-gun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and he and Robert Leiter, the assistant director, who is also, I guess, the general counsel of the ATF. I mean, those two have basically been spearheading the efforts to undo some of the Biden era rules, to review some of the rules. So like the end of the zero tolerance policy, I think, was a direct result of what Sakata and Leiter were doing. I know that the engaged in the business rule is currently under review, and the expectation is that too is going to be formally undone. But then we've seen a lot of other smaller, rule changes, things that are maybe more technical in nature that aren't quite as headline grabbing.
But that work is again continued, you know, throughout Leiter's term as Sakata's term as deputy director. So I'm with you. I'm cautiously optimistic as well. There's no David Chipman. I'll say that. Right. No. And I don't think even Steve Dettelbach. So and besides American Suppressor Association, I know that Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep Bear Arms has come out in support of Sakata's nomination, and NSSF has as well. So those are all encouraging signs. And I think that President Trump has made a good pick here. I also want to get your thoughts. I had Representative Andrew Klein on the show yesterday. We were talking about his letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi, I guess, has 30 co-sponsors or 30 co-signers in the House. Basically encouraging slash demanding the DOJ align itself with the intent of Congress and the One Big Beautiful Bill Act as it pertains to NFA taxes and registration. The administration, as you and I have talked before, Knox, has unfortunately, you know, we've got an assistant U.S. attorney in Louisiana that declared the $200 tax a modest burden on our Second Amendment rights. The registration requirements, again, a similarly modest burden. And the administration, the DOJ at this point, continues to defend the registration requirements under the NFA. As Andrew Clyde said, you know, listen, it was the Senate parliamentarian who decided that the registration requirements had to stand. It wasn't the will of the House. It wasn't the will of the Senate. It was the will of one person who's not an elected official. What do you think about the idea of Congress, putting some pressure on the DOJ to fall in line with the congressional intent of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act?
I mean, look, I think broadly speaking, what Andrew Clyde and those other members of Congress did and said in that letter is largely in line with what the American people want. And I think it's largely in line with what the Trump administration wants, too. You know, look at, you know, things like their nomination of Sakata to run the ATF. They think he's going to be a good pro-Second Amendment arbiter and head of that agency. Look at, you know, all of the things that they've done. It's not a perfect Second Amendment administration, but it is by far the best Second Amendment administration that we've got. And with all things, it takes time, right? Like, we can't expect, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. We can't expect things to change overnight. But I think that the pace with which this administration has taken pro-Second Amendment steps in this second Trump administration has been phenomenal and incredibly encouraging. I also think that, you know, really the true test is going to be what the government's response is in these other NFA cases, right? We do have one bad apple in that assistant U.S. attorney in Eastern District of Louisiana with the Peterson case. But how do they respond in these other cases? We have two lawsuits that we filed with the NRA, Second Amendment Foundation, and FPC that are all in the coming months going to have to be responded to by the government. And I think that if we see some of those same responses, then that will be an indicator that that's systemic within the DOJ and thus the administration. But if they're different, then it's really going to highlight the fact that, hey, that really was one bad actor who's just out of step with the Department of Justice, with Pam Bondi, and with President Trump.
Yeah. And in fact, there are a couple of NFA cases that I guess are pending review by the Supreme Court justices in conference, right? You've got Rush versus U.S. and Robinson versus U.S. And, you know, in Rush, for example, the Solicitor General, you know, essentially took the position that this is okay, right? Or that the NFA has some questionable aspects to it, that this is not exactly a great case, right, for the court to take. But I mean, bottom line, in Rush versus the United States, which deals with short-barreled rifles, Solicitor General wrote, the Court of Appeals correctly rejected the argument that the NFA's registration requirement violates the Second Amendment on its face. So, I mean, that's, you know, bottom line, that's the DOJ taking the position that the registration requirement of the NFA is, in fact, compliant with the Second Amendment. And that is a position that certainly is contrary to a lot of Second Amendment supporters around the country. Sure.
Yeah. And rightfully so. You know, again, that gives us something to work on. It gives us something to push the administration on. You know, I hope that they will get in line with that. But, you know, time will tell. And we certainly commend Andrew Clyde and the other members of Congress who signed on to that letter, because, you know, we agree with their position.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, and ultimately January 1st, One Big Beautiful Bill Act takes effect. The $200 stamp tax goes away. Hopefully the registration requirement goes away too. I'm not even sure how, given that the registration is a registry that you paid the tax, which is now zeroed out. I don't even know how the registration requirement can be enforced, but I guess, you know, we'll see what happens a couple of months from now.
Yep.
But, you know, we are expecting to see, I think, a surge in interest in folks who, you know, now can get a suppressor a little bit cheaper than they have been able to in the past. Going back to the ATF, I think, you know, we saw even during the shutdown, it was a good sign that the administration recognized, okay, the ATF folks who are processing NFA applications, they need to be on the job and continuing to process that. So, you know, that was a good development. Where do you see, you know, the suppressor industry right now? Just a couple of months, well, not even less than 2 months before the One Big Beautiful Bill Act takes effect.
There's a tremendous amount of excitement in the industry, right? I think that people see this as an opportunity for our market to continue to grow. Look, when we formed the American Suppressor Association in 2011, there were 285,000 suppressors in the NFRTR, which means that from 1934 up until 2011, 285,000 suppressors had been made and registered with the federal government, because the ATF didn't exist in 1934. I digress. Fast forward to today, there's likely over 5 million. Right. So that's been a tremendous period of growth. And it's something that we think is going to continue to grow at a 20, 30, 40, 50% rate year over year. This is obviously going to be, you know, one of the most dynamic changes to the National Firearms Act in its 91 year history. That is so cool. And I think one other thing to kind of step back and evidence for us as to why a guy like Sakata is such a good pick. It was no accident that those examiners were called back to work and classified as accepted personnel, which is the technical term to basically mean, you know, colloquially essential personnel during the government shutdown. You know, we worked directly with the ATF. You know, we gave them quite a few talking points on like, hey, here's our argument as to why we think that the folks processing NFA applications should be brought back to work. You've got the folks at the FBI still processing NICS applications. Those are firearms applications. It is thus an infringement upon your Second Amendment rights as a citizen to not be able to purchase these types of firearms, which under federal law, suppressors are classified as firearms as well as, you know, all the other NFA items. Mm-hmm. And that did not fall on deaf ears. This was not the first time since 2011 that the government has shut down. It's happened, what, 3, 4, 5 times since then. We've made those same arguments and they always fell on deaf ears until now. And Sakata was a major part of that. You know, so this idea that like, oh, these guys were just magically called back in. No, that took a lot of pushing from ASA and it took receptive audience in folks like Robert Leiter and Sakata to make that happen, to then go make that ask to DOJ, who then makes that ask to the Office of Management and Budget, who then greenlights it, right? Why? Because it was the right thing to do. And for us, things like that are proof positive that Sakata is the right guy for that job, if that makes sense.
Well, and to piggyback on that, you know, I mean, again, we've noted that the DOJ has taken the position that, you know, these taxes are a modest burden on the Second Amendment. But they have also said that suppressors are, in fact, protected by the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. which helped make your case, right? You are now preventing by not having those trainers or examiners there in place. It was infringing on the ability to exercise our Second Amendment rights. And I'm glad that there was that receptive audience at DOJ and ATF and OMB as well to put that in place. You know, we are in the early days, at least in Virginia, of the fall deer season. I could tell when deer season started because I love the sound. My Great Pyrenees hates the sound of gunshots, but... You know, I'm curious. I mean, do you see when you talk about the growth in suppressors? My first thought is, you know, going to the range. And I want to talk about this New York Times story that ran a couple of weeks ago before we go. But are you seeing more use of suppressors out in the field as well and not just in the range at the range?
Oh, tremendously. Look, like when I got into the suppressor industry in 2009, that was my first job. I worked at Advanced Armament. It was almost exclusively used suppressors in the black gun community, right? Like it was all tactical. It was all that. Right now, I think that the majority of the suppressors that are being made and sold are largely for things like bolt action rifles and hunting applications, right? It has been a dynamic shift. I think we played a pretty major role in that over the course of the tenure of our organization. We've helped legalize suppressor hunting in 19 states. In fact, that was one of the reasons why we formed the American Suppressor Association in the first place, because my home state of Georgia, I wanted to be able to hunt and you couldn't do it. It took us 3 years to get that law changed. But now, you know, hunters are coming wise to the fact that like, hey, like I don't have to sacrifice my hearing because I like to shoot or because I like to hunt. And yeah, I might be able to, you know, pretend that, you know, I'm macho and I can power through this. But like all you're doing is permanently damaging your hearing every time you expose your ears to an unsuppressed gunshot without hearing protection. Even sometimes with hearing protection, it's not enough. Right. Suppressors really are one of the most effective tools to help mitigate hearing damage, especially in a condition where we know 70 to 80% of hunters nationwide not sometimes use hearing protection, literally never wear hearing protection in the field. Why? Because they want to maintain their auditory situational awareness. They want to be able to hear, detect, and localize sound. And that's something that's very hard to do if you have traditional hearing protection. Even electronic hearing protection is very difficult to localize sound. So they're good at detecting like, hey, I can hear that there is a noise, but it's very hard to mimic accurately an open ear condition because our ears have been developed over millions of years, right? Through evolution to effectively and efficiently transmit sound waves into our brain. And when you occlude the ear canal, it is very, very difficult for something to replicate the way that our body can localize sound, meaning like I hear a sound and I know by hearing it that it's behind me and to my left or in front of me and to my right. So really suppressors are one of the most effective ways for people, practically speaking, to protect their hearing while they're in the field. And I think people are loving it. And I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing such a renaissance in the suppressor area is because people are saying, look, like we could be the last generation. Our generation could be the last of hunters that lose our hearing because we hunt. What a cool world to live in.
Well, and you know, do you think that there's also an overall effect on, does this open the door for more people to participate in hunting?
Absolutely, right? People want to do something that's neat and cool and fun. They don't want to do what their granddad did or what their dad did, right? Because it's not cool. We all fell into that trap. And as you get older, you start to realize like, hey, man, they were actually pretty cool, you know? But like kids don't want to hear that, right? They want to do the new cool thing. And right now, thankfully, protecting your hearing is cool. How neat is that?
Right. Absolutely. Which, you know, so it brings me to that New York Times article that ran a couple of weeks ago. And I got to say, I mean, at first I thought, okay, it's the New York Times. They're writing about guns. It's going to be a hit piece. Talking about, you know, the damage that can be done to the brain through the concussive waves of a gunshot, particularly at enclosed ranges. Right. And that was one of the things that they talked about is that, okay, if you're shooting outside, the blast effects are greatly mitigated, as opposed to shooting in an indoor range where, you know, you got the walls beside you. But they also noted that if you put a suppressor on a firearm, even in shooting indoors, you basically get rid of any danger, of the, you know, even over time, the repetitive nature of firearms and the effects of that shockwave can have on your brain. I did not expect, Knox, to see the New York Times essentially endorse the idea of suppressors, not only to save your hearing, but to save your brain as well.
Yeah, man, you know it must be true when even the New York Times is saying that suppressors are beneficial from a health perspective when it comes to shooting, right? Like, what a world to live in. And yeah, I mean, it turns out that exposing your brain to concussions and to explosions, which a gunshot is an explosion, right? Like it's a controlled explosion pushing a projectile out of a barrel, right? Exposing your brain to that is not good, right? And one of our board members on our foundation is a guy named Dr. Adam Mellenbacher. He is an Army vet, deployed to Iraq. He is a doctor of audiology, and he actually does blast research at Duke University. And I asked him after that article came out, like, hey, man, like, are these effects short-term or long-term? And his exact response was, that's what we're researching. We don't know, right? So like, we have no idea the long-term effects yet of exposure to these things, but we know it can't be good, right? And suppressors are, again, not just the hearing, but also containing that concussive effect, right? It just has positive health benefits, right? And yeah, people are going to say, oh, well, you know, these things make a gun too quiet. They don't. That is totally untrue. It makes it less loud, but it absolutely makes it less dangerous for the shooter and for anyone around them. What's wrong with that?
Absolutely. All right. So last question. I mean, again, we've got the One Big Beautiful Bill Act taking effect. The $200 tax goes away January 1st. But obviously the push to deregulate suppressors is going to continue, right? To either get rid of the NFA altogether or to remove suppressors from the NFA. What are your goals for 2026?
Man, I think that's just it. Continue to push, strike while the iron's hot, right? I think that, you know, we're very fortunate coming out of the One Big Beautiful Bill that a lot of lawmakers and a lot of the country have woken up to the fact that these regulations are draconian, they're overburdensome, and they're ridiculous, especially now that you've got an entire tax regime that is based on nothing. Now, I'm going to caveat that with the fact that this is all going to take time. Nothing is going to change overnight. At least we can't expect that. If it happens, fantastic. But it has taken us 14 years to get to this point. You know, we don't expect it to take 14 days to finish the drill, so to speak. So it's going to take time, but that's why we're working with members of Congress. That's why we're working with the White House, who has been incredibly receptive. You know, we're very excited to see what sort of regulations can come out of ATF, especially if Sakata gets confirmed by the Senate and takes over as the political director of the ATF. I think that there's a lot of good that can come from that. And we have certainly have high expectations. And look, if he doesn't pan out, it's not a permanent appointment. You know, he serves at the pleasure of the president. If he is a bad pick and he starts doing bad things, then we have direct recourse. And you bet your bottom dollar that we're going to be lobbying the administration to say, hey, get this guy out and get somebody good in. So there will be some pressure on Sakata, but we do feel confident that he's the right guy for that job. And look, at the state level, you know, we're going to continue to push our litigation efforts. We've got two lawsuits that the ASA and the ASA Foundation are funding, you know, fighting the constitutionality of suppressor bans. You know, hopefully we can see some good action on that. And our lawsuits challenging the National Firearms Act. You know, again, these things are all going to take time to work their way through the system, but they're out there and they're working. And man, we just can't wait to see what the future brings.
Well, I appreciate everything that you guys are doing there, the American Suppressor Association. Always enjoy our conversations, Knox. And happy shooting to you, sir. Look forward to doing this again very soon.
Yes, sir. And likewise. Thank you so much, Cam.
Thanks once again to Knox for joining us on the program. So, you know, I mentioned Rush and Robinson versus United States. Those are two cases dealing with the NFA's restrictions on, I think both of those actually deal with the SBRs. So we're still waiting for the Supreme Court to assign a conference date to consider those two cases. The reply, all of the briefings are in. So it's just a matter of the court deciding when it's going to take up these petitions in their weekly conference. At today's conference, they are scheduled to consider three Second Amendment cases, Vincent versus Bondi, Duarte versus United States, and Carbajal Flores versus United States. Vincent versus Bondi and Duarte versus United States both essentially deal with the federal prohibition on firearm possession for anybody convicted of a crime punishable by more than 1 year in prison, regardless of whether or not that offense is a violent offense or not. And the question that both Vincent and Duarte are asking the court to address is whether or not essentially a conviction for a nonviolent offense like that can result in a lifetime prohibition on the right to keep and bear arms without violating our Second Amendment rights. Carbajal Flores versus the United States deals with the federal law that prevents or prohibits people who are in this country illegally from possessing a firearm and asks whether or not that law violates the right of the people to keep and bear arms. I have to say, I will be surprised if the Supreme Court takes Carbajal Flores, given that the lower court said no, an individual who's in this country legally essentially is not a part of the people and therefore does not have any Second Amendment rights. That to me seems to be a fairly common sense provision or decision. But, again, we'll see what SCOTUS has to say. Vincent and Duarte, you know, I've talked about this before. I've never met Melinda Vincent, who is the plaintiff in Vincent versus Bondi, but I have to say I'm an admirer of what she's done with her life. I mean, when she was I can't remember if she pled guilty or was convicted of writing a bad check. It was 17 years ago. At the time, Melinda Vincent was a drug addict. I think she might have been homeless at the time. In bad straits. But she has since turned her life around. She has conquered addiction. She's become a drug and alcohol counselor herself. She's got a private practice, but she also works with the state of Utah. She's a single mom. She wants to own a firearm for self-protection, but also would like to go and, you know, engage in the shooting sports with her kids. And to me, it is a clear violation of our Second Amendment rights that somebody like Melinda Vincent would be forevermore prohibited from owning a firearm because of a mistake that she made 17 years ago. That she has paid restitution. She has, you know, served her probationary sentence. I believe she was sentenced to nothing more than probation for that crime. And I hope that the Supreme Court is going to take Melinda Vincent's case. Duarte, a little bit different. Duarte, actually, Mr. Duarte is represented by Paul Clement, who is a, you know, Second Amendment powerhouse. The circumstance is a little bit different. He has a little bit more of a criminal record, all again for nonviolent offenses, but more recent offenses as well, compared to Melinda Vincent. So the two cases together, if the court were to decide to accept one or both of those cases, I think it would be very, very good for Second Amendment jurisprudence. I suspect that the court would come down in favor, at least to some large degree, in favor of the petitions by the plaintiffs here. And again, going back to the Rahimi case, where the Supreme Court said that somebody can be temporarily deprived of their Second Amendment rights based on a judicial determination of dangerousness. Well, if you apply that logic, if it takes a judicial determination of dangerousness to temporarily deprive somebody of their right to keep their arm, shouldn't there also be that determination of dangerousness to permanently deny somebody their right to keep and bear arms? And can you really argue that somebody who wrote a bad check 17 years ago, or even 7 days ago, should be presumed to be dangerous, right? The DOJ has taken the position essentially that, look, we've got this proposed rule where people who are prohibited from owning firearms can apply to the Attorney General and have their rights restored. That is a vehicle that Ms. Vincent and Mr. Duarte should avail themselves of. There's no reason for the court to hear this case now. The problem with that is that, A, the proposed rule is not in effect yet, so they cannot apply to the Attorney General to have their rights restored at the moment. But B, the question is on the federal statute itself, right? So it's not just about, these are as applied challenges. So I don't think they're asking that the statute be thrown out, facially, that it's unconstitutional in every conceivable aspect. But we are still talking about cases that will have an impact going forward, right? So it's not just about Melinda Vincent or Mr. Duarte. It is about those individuals in the future who would be convicted of similar offenses and, again, automatically lose the right to keep and bear arms. The question is whether or not that is allowed under the Second Amendment. And that is a question that I think the court should address sooner rather than later. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a story out of New Mexico. 13-year-old who brought gun to Albuquerque Middle School receives probation. Yeah. Remember a couple of years ago when Michelle Lujan Grisham was so concerned about juvenile crime in Albuquerque that she decided to ban lawful concealed carry among adults throughout Albuquerque and Bernalillo County. And then she got sued and she's like, fine. Maybe not the entire county, maybe not the entire city, but parks and playgrounds. You can't carry guns there. And eventually she settled on it because the court said, you can't do that with parks. Eventually it got whittled down to you can't carry in playgrounds. That litigation is still ongoing, by the way. And Governor Lujan Grisham has continued to bemoan what she considers a lack of gun control in New Mexico. She was very upset that New Mexico Democrats have not passed a semi-auto ban. Threatened to call them back in a special session. It didn't happen. She has talked tough about juvenile crime, but the reality on the ground is that, you know, juvenile offenders are still getting away with slaps on the wrist. In this particular case, it was a 13-year-old who brought a loaded gun to Jimmy Carter Middle School and threatened two students. So this wasn't just a case of, you know, Billy's dad put his gun in Billy's backpack and Billy didn't realize it until he got to school. No. This 13-year-old intentionally brought a loaded firearm to school and threatened fellow students. And he got nothing more than 2 years probation. He had previously admitted to unlawful carrying of a firearm on school campus, as well as two counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, as well as unlawful possession of a handgun by a person under the age of 19. The DA's office had asked for the teen to spend at least 1 year in custody, but the judge said no and ordered nothing more than, again, 2 years probation for the 13-year-old. Which, like it or not, essentially tells that 13-year-old that this wasn't a big deal. And my fear is that the lesson that this 13-year-old is going to take from this is that he can violate the law. He can illegally carry a gun. He can illegally threaten people with that gun. And there really won't be any consequences other than, you know, again, checking in with a probation officer once a week, maybe less. Not getting arrested again. Not getting caught again. In my mind, even a 1 year sentence would have been a little light, but it would have been something. And you know, I don't know what Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's response to this will be, if any, by the way, but, this is the issue here when you're dealing with violent crime. It's not lawful gun owners. In many cases, it is the soft on crime criminal justice system, which is particularly a problem when it comes to juvenile justice in this country. Today's Armed Citizen story from Jacksonville, not Jacksonville, Florida, I don't think. This was, it was Jacksonville, Florida. From Jacksonville, Florida. Suspect shot during Jacksonville home invasion, captured after stealing victim's car, police say. This was Tuesday afternoon, just after 12:30. Man living at a home on Arlex Drive, who's believed to be in his 70s, told police that somebody who was armed with a gun broke in through a window in the back of his home. The victim said he was ordered into a back bedroom. He was ordered to hand over his car keys and other valuables. But when he was in the bedroom, he was able to grab his gun, managed to shoot the suspect once in the shoulder. The suspect reportedly fled the home after he was shot, drove off in the victim's car. It took about half an hour for the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office to find the suspect inside the vehicle, just a couple miles away. Taken into custody near Jacksonville University. The suspect, not yet publicly identified, taken to a local hospital by first responders for the gunshot wound. Now in police custody. The victim in this case, not expected to face any charges. I would say when an armed guy breaks into your home and starts robbing you, yeah, you have a reasonable fear for your life under those circumstances. But we'll keep our eyes open for any more details and updates to that story. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Atlanta who rescued a man after an apartment basically blew up near Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Happened Tuesday night, and the guy who saved the individual inside that building said he was simply in the right place at the right time. Clayton Still, a veteran driving home from an Atlanta Hawks game, and he actually felt the concussive force of the explosion. He said it sounded like a bomb had gone off. Explosion injured one man, left debris scattered across the area near Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Fire officials said that the apartment was vacant at the time, was actually being renovated. So Still, you know, parks his car, gets out. He said he saw chaos and destruction, people screaming, but he heard faint cries for help coming from inside the building. And he said, you know, you could hear just faintly like, hey, we need help. We need help. So he ran towards the building, climbed the stairs to reach the second floor, where he found a man. He said he was suffering from severe burns. He said he was able to pick up the man, grabbed him out, handed him to waiting police officers who then passed him off to medics, who took him to a Grady Memorial Hospital. Property management officials say that they believe the explosion might have been caused by someone attempting to steal copper from the apartments that are being renovated. An open flame ignited gas inside one of the units. Again, so far, what we know is that, again, that one individual was seriously injured. I don't know if there were other injuries, but and the identity of the man who was rescued has not been released, so we don't have an update on his condition. But, again, in the right place at the right time, we're unable to do the right thing for a stranger in need. Clayton Still, we thank you for your very, very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Scam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back again on Monday. But between now and then, I would encourage you to check out BearingArms.com. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information, including the dogs that are barking in Virginia, where this past Monday, you can start pre-filing bills for the 2026 session. We have not seen a gun control bill filed. We know they're coming. The Democrats are keeping their gun control plans very close to the vest this time around, as opposed to 6 years ago, the last time they had complete control of this government. They made it very clear very early on they were going to pass a sweeping gun ban, mobilizing gun owners, sparking the Second Amendment Sanctuary Movement. They don't want a repeat of that. So they're keeping quiet about their anti-gun agenda. We've got a story on that and much more waiting for you at BearingArms.com. If you like what you see, would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can take 60% off your membership. Again, have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you soon. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.